1 Kings 18. We're going to be looking at the main event today, which may not mean exactly what you think it means at the end of the day. I enjoy a good showdown. I've always been a fan of MMA fighting. When we were living in Las Vegas, a lot of MMA fighters there. I actually had about three MMA fighters that attended our church. And so I've always kind of kept up with UFC. And if you go back a few decades, I used to watch boxing, and so I'm always up for a good showdown. I love the announcers of showdowns, right, of UFC. The UFC announcer is a guy named Bruce Buffer, and if you ever see big UFC fights, he always comes out, and he has the two opponents, and he always says, "It's time!" There's also the famous, "It's time to rumble," right? Ready to rumble. What is it? Something about rumbling. But I always love a good showdown.
This is not Tyson versus Holyfield. It's not Luke Skywalker versus Darth Vader. Not Daniel LaRusso versus Johnny Lawrence. Remember that showdown? The Karate Kid. Wax on, wax off. That's not the type of showdown we're talking about. It's not Harry Potter versus Voldemort. Sorry, Kaylee. It's not Roadrunner versus Wile E. Coyote. It's not brown rice versus white rice, hamburgers versus hot dogs. It's not even UNC versus Duke or Auburn versus Alabama. It's not even Gulf Shores versus Orange Beach. It's not even Devon versus ants. If you know my story, you know I lose the battle to ants every single time. I got bit like seven times yesterday. My left foot is literally crammed into my shoe. So if I take off my shoe, I would look like Shrek on the left foot of my body. This is not the showdown we're talking about. It's not the Thrilla in Manila, which was Ali versus Frazier. Did anyone in here watch that live? You're showing your age if you hold your hand up. There's a few people here that saw that showdown live. It's not boxing. It's not UFC. It's not WWE Stone Cold Austin versus The Undertaker. Can I get an amen? It's not sports or TV or movies. It's not food or even vacation spots. This showdown is of biblical proportions, literally, and it's taken 3 years in the making. Let me bring this up to speed. We're talking about a prophet named Elijah, who was the prophet to the northern kingdom of a divided Israel at that time. He was a prophet that was sent to the most notorious couple probably in all of the Bible, Ahab and Jezebel. And suddenly this nobody of a prophet appears out of nowhere and announces on behalf of God that there will be no rain in the country until he speaks the word. Now that meant a lot for that culture. It meant death. It meant poverty. It meant the economic system would literally shut down because rain was vital to their survival. God then takes Elijah, as we've learned the last few weeks. He sends him into exile by the brook Cherith, where he drinks from the waters of the brook and is fed by ravens. How cool is that? Until the brook dries up. The severity of the drought dries up the brook, and God sends his prophet on to Zarephath, where God cares for Elijah through a Gentile widow in the land of Jezebel herself. And there, Elijah and this widow, and if you hear our last Elijah sermon, the widow and her son are both spared from starvation, and then God literally raises the son from the dead. God has protected Elijah. God has prepared Elijah. And now it's time for this pending showdown. And we arrive in 1 Kings chapter 18. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the, what year was it? Third year, year three, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab and I will send rain upon the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. If we had Bruce Buffer back in that day, he would stand in the center of the king's court and say, "It's time for the showdown." God sends Elijah back into the presence of Ahab and Jezebel for this pending showdown. Now, in the meantime, there has been an APB out on Elijah. Ahab and Jezebel have gone to great lengths. He is the top of Israel's most notorious wanted list. They believe it's Elijah's fault, so they have sent warriors, they have sent soldiers out to kill the prophets of God, in particular Elijah. If you were to read between the story, between the lines, the rest of 1 Kings 18, we're going to skip a portion of that text. You would read about a prophet named Obadiah, who actually wrote a very small book in the Old Testament, the minor prophet Obadiah. Obadiah enters the story, and Obadiah meets Elijah face to face, and Elijah says to Obadiah, "It's time for me to meet with Ahab. It's time for the showdown." And so Obadiah sets up this meeting. And this is just a reminder that Ahab's not in control. Jezebel's not in control. God is in absolute control. And just like when Elijah announced before the king, rain will come when God says it will come. And now Elijah's there to say, the time has come. Let's set up this meeting. And so they set up a meeting. We're going to skip to verse 17 and pick it up there. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" I love how Ahab goes all Kathy Griffin on Elijah. "Elijah, it's your fault that there is a drought in Israel. It's your fault that all this trouble has come. You are the troubler of the city." This sounds very culturally relevant to what's been going on in our culture, to say something and then blame someone else when they retaliate, right? And so this is what's going on with Ahab and Elijah. Ahab says to Elijah, "You are the troubler." The Hebrew word here, troubler, actually can be translated snake. "You snake in the grass." Just yesterday, Toby found his annual snake at our house. He always finds a snake at least once a year. And he has a different growl for a snake than he does any other creature. He brutally and viciously attacked and destroyed a groundhog last week. It was very nasty. It made my wife sick to her stomach as he literally shook it to death. And you could hear bones cracking and all those fun things that happens on the food chain of life. But even in that moment, the growl for a snake was different. Because he is built instinctively to not like snakes and not have them around our house. And so Ahab says to Elijah, "You are a snake in the grass. You are the troubler of Israel." And Elijah quickly responds, "It's not me, dude." Verse 18, and he answered, "I have not troubled Israel. You have. And your father's house." Here's the reason: because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed the Baals. I told you in week one of the Elijah series, Elijah was a country boy. And this confirms Elijah was a country boy because he says, "You have worshipped the Baals." You like that? Country boy, the Baals, the Walmart, the whatever. Elijah was a country boy. "You have served the Baals." Keep on, verse 19, Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah," that's 850 total, "who eat at Jezebel's table." I don't know if you read the Bible like I do, but when I read that, I think, man, that had to be a big table to seat 850 people. Like, that's a big table. That's not going to fit in our dining room for sure. I don't think it meant at the same time, but they're eating at Jezebel's table. Elijah's point is, it's time for the showdown. You have abandoned God. You have followed Baal. Now, picture the scene. This is 3 years of drought. This is 3 years of death. This is 3 years of severe famine. I imagine the stench of death filled the land. I imagine there were dead animals. There were destitute people. It was a time of deep poverty, and Ahab's looking, like all of us, for someone to blame. He blames Elijah. Elijah says, "This is not my fault. This is your fault that you have not followed God. The stench of death that you smell in the air is on you." It's time for the ultimate showdown. In the midst of death, the stench of death that permeates the land, it's time to see who is God. And he sets the stage for the showdown. Bring all of Israel, bring all the false prophets. It's time
for God to show up. What's at stake here is bigger than just the scene that we have read. What's at stake is God's people have violated the most intentional, the most important commandment of all, the very first command of the Big Ten. God said, "I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me." That's the first and most important of all the commands, because that command controls everything else that comes after it. "I am the Lord your God," God says to his people. "You shall have no other gods before me." That statement is true or it's not true. Either he is God or he's not God. If he is God, then it makes sense that there would be no other gods before him. And so what's at stake here ultimately is a violation of the very core and central command in all of Scripture, that God is who he claims to be and that there are no other gods before him. Look at verse 21. Or 20, God, Ahab sent to all the people of Israel, they gathered all the prophets at Mount Carmel, the place of the showdown. Verse 21, and Elijah came near to all the people and said, listen to his words, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal," implied here, "is God, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Ultimately, this showdown is not about Ahab and Elijah. It's not Ahab versus Elijah. Ultimately, the issue that's at stake here is the issue of God's supremacy, God's priority, God's sovereignty. Who or what sits on the throne of your life, God is saying to the Israelite people. Who are you going to follow? Now, we read this text and texts like it in the Old Testament, our minds automatically go to that word idol, right? Idolatry. When we think of idolatry, we often think of bells and stone or metal statues or some animal that's been crafted into something that people worship. That's kind of what our minds go to. We tend to ignore the word idol or idolatry because it evokes in our minds kind of an outdated or antiquated statue or some image of an animal. But idolatry is not about symbols. It's not about stone or metal or animals that have been crafted out of wood. Idolatry is not about symbols. Idolatry is about the heart. Here's what modern idolatry looks like. Modern idolatry is anything that I want more than I want God. That becomes an idol to me. Anything I want more than God. Anything I rely on more than God. Anywhere I look to find fulfillment, to find contentment, to find satisfaction, anywhere that I look to find any of those things, fulfillment, contentment, satisfaction, value, anywhere that I look other than God, that becomes an idol to me. You see, the first command is as relevant today as it was in Elijah's day or Moses' day or wherever your mind goes when you hear the word idol. Idolatry is a heart matter. Idolatry is that unseen sin that drives all of our external, outward sins. The major sins in our lives are deeper than just the symptom. The symptom is the sin. But the major issue, idolatry, is deeper than just the symptom. The sin, the symptom, reveals itself externally, right? The sin comes out externally. But every sin ultimately points to something which we do not believe or trust about God. It's rooted in unbelief. I do not believe God in an area of my life, or I do not trust God in an area of my life. And so that leads me to place my hope, my trust, my value, my identity in something other than God. Let me illustrate it for you. We'll use lying as an example. Why do we lie? I mean, lying is the symptom of the sin. It's the outward display of sin. But there's a few underlying reasons why a person might lie. A person might lie because they fear the disapproval of people more than they value the approval of God. Maybe they value the approval of people more than they value the approval of God, and so they lie. They lie to seek approval from humans. In that moment, they are seeking human approval more than they're seeking God's approval. Lying is a sin for that reason. In my heart, my idol becomes I'm seeking the approval of others. I might lie because I value my reputation or I value my image. And so I'll lie to protect my reputation. I'll lie to protect my image. And in that moment, I value myself, my reputation, my image more than I value a pure relationship with God. So in that moment, that becomes my idol. Lying is the outward display of what's really going on in my heart, the idolatry happening in my soul. I might lie because I'm trying to manipulate someone to give me something. To give me something maybe I feel like I need. And in that moment, I'm trying to manipulate someone to give me something that I feel that I need more than trusting in what God provides. Lying becomes an issue of the heart. It's idolatry of the heart that displays itself outwardly in the form of lying. But it's really not about lying, is it? It's what's going on behind the lie that causes me to value something more than I value God in that moment. My reputation, what I'm seeking to obtain, manipulating someone to get something I think I need. There's a lot of symptoms that display themselves outwardly, but it's really idolatry of the heart. Visible sins are driven by the internal turning of my heart towards something or someone other than God. God as the source of my fulfillment, my security, my value. In that moment, I am turning my heart towards something, towards someone. I am valuing that more than I'm valuing God. That's what idolatry is. That's the heart of the first commandment. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That doesn't mean necessarily stone statues or metal images of animals. That means I should not value or trust in or place anything in my life over God. Here's the danger of idols, of false gods. The danger is that they promise only what God can provide. False gods, the things that we tend to put our trust in, they promise things that only God can provide. They promise you a better life. If you will do X, Y, and Z, you will have a better life. If you will trust in money, if you will trust in things, if you will trust in job, you will have a better life. They promise you a better life. That's only something God can provide. It promises you contentment, promises you happiness, value, security, identity, so many things. And the danger of idols, modern day idols, the things we tend to put our trust in, false gods, they promise us only what God can provide. So here's the warning about idols, and you've heard me say this before. Idols come in various forms, including, don't miss this, this is probably the most relevant thing we'll talk about today, including good things. Good things that we make ultimate things in our lives. Good things. Our children, good things. You guys are like the children of Israel. Awkward silence when Elijah asked the question. Children are great things, right? I have four of them, all the way from a young lady who's about to turn 20 down to a young man who's 8 months old. I know. It's a big, wide age variety. Children are great things. I can't tell you outside of, you know, my family, my wife, and my children, there's nothing I love more in the world than my kids. And I now find myself as a parent saying what our parents said to us, you're not going to understand love until you have your own. And my dad would say that, and I would roll his eyes, and now I say that all the time. I think I said that to Kaylee this past week. I value my kids. Kids are great things. Kids are good things. But kids were not created to be ultimate things. When I make the child the ultimate thing, it stands in the place of God. When the kid becomes the center of my world over Jesus, I have made that child, who is a gift from God, a good thing that is standing in the place of an ultimate thing. Our relationships, good things. Relationships are great things. We were created as relational beings, but the moment that a relationship becomes the ultimate thing in my life, it takes the place of God in my life, then it becomes an idol in my life. And having a spouse that you love is a great thing, but the moment that spouse that is a good and great thing becomes the ultimate something. I have committed idolatry in my heart. Physical appearance and physical attentiveness and being in shape is a great thing, a good thing. But the moment that becomes the center of my world and takes that ultimate place, it has become an idol in my life. Having a job is a good thing. The moment it becomes the ultimate thing, it becomes an idol in my life. Having financial stability, money is a good thing, a powerful thing. The moment that it becomes the ultimate thing, it takes the place of God in my life. Stuff, things. Having stuff is a good thing, can be a great thing. The moment it becomes my heartbeat, the drive of my life, it has become an idol in my life. Let me do one personal. Ministry is a good thing. Ministry is a great thing. The moment that ministry becomes the ultimate thing in my life, I have replaced Jesus with something else and broken the very first command. Friends are a good thing. We could go through the list, right? Good things that we look to fill the space reserved for God alone. Most idols are not staring you in the face, are golden calves that are saying, bow down and worship me. Most idols in our life are good things that we tend to make ultimate things. Idolatry, the sin of the heart. Elijah's challenge in this text still rings so loudly to us today. Elijah challenges the people of God. That's why his challenge is so important. Stop limping between opinions. Stop limping between opinions. I like what Elijah does. Elijah draws a line in the sand and he says, look, if God is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. The same thing is true of our idols today. If whatever that idol is in your life, if that is God or you treat it as God, go all in. Sell all out to it. Follow that completely. As we read through the text, worship it, dance before it, bleed for it, sacrifice for it, blood, sweat, and tears for it, sacrifice to give to it, tithe to it. By the way, whatever your idol is, you're already tithing to it. You're giving your money in that direction, I can guarantee you. If that's Jesus or if that's your stuff, you're already tithing toward it. You're already sacrificing for it. You're bleeding toward it. And Elijah says to us, stop limping between opinions. If money is God, go all in. Try to earn as much as you possibly can. If relationships are God, go all in. If sex is God, by all means, pursue it. Go after it. Go after it full force. Do everything you can for it. There's a line drawn in the sand. Elijah says, stop limping between opinions. If physical attractiveness is God, then go for it. By all means, go all in. Follow it. Sacrifice for it. Worship it. Dance before it. If power is God, go all in. Become as powerful as you can. If success is God, go all in. Become as successful as you possibly can. If recognition is God, do everything you can to obtain recognition. Sacrifice for it. Worship before it. Bleed before it. There's a line in the sand. Stop limping between opinions. If God is God, follow him as if he is God. If something else, someone else is God, follow it. Follow that person as if they are God. For us, idolatry is not about the bells. It is about who or what occupies the supreme place of my heart. Stop limping between opinions. What am I putting before God in my life? It's probably a good thing that has become the ultimate thing. Elijah was a believer in what we call monotheism. That is the belief in one God. The word mono means one. Theism means God. He believed in one God. Elijah was prophesying in a culture that was polytheistic. Poly means many gods. Poly word many, theism God. Polytheism. He was a monotheist, a belief in one God, preaching and proclaiming in a culture of polytheism, much like the culture of our day, many gods. Now, here's what I'm afraid of. I'm not afraid that most Jesus followers are going to go out and bend their knee toward stone idols or worship Big Buddha or something like that. But what I am afraid of is that we are monotheistic people that claim to believe in one God, but we live polytheistic lives. That we live lives that seem to worship a lot of different gods. Don't limp between opinions. Elijah lays out the ground rules, 22. Elijah said to the people, "I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord. Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." And all the people answered, "It is well spoken." They agreed to it. So basically, Elijah lays out the ground rules. You guys are going to build an altar and put a sacrifice on it. I will build an altar and put a sacrifice on it. You have home field advantage. You can cry out to your God. You're going to receive the kickoff first. You're going to try to score, try to get the first touchdown. God's going to answer by fire. If Baal shows up and answers by fire, then we will know he is God. I will pray to my God, and if my God shows up, we will know he is God. Now, again, don't forget, Baal is the sun god. Baal is the God who should be able to answer by fire. Again, Elijah's giving them the home field advantage, 25. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon. So whatever, 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock. "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped. So notice the wordplay there. When Elijah challenged the people, stop limping between opinions. And they limped around the altar that they made. This is what I love about Elijah. Check out this next verse. "And at noon, Elijah mocked them. He made fun of them. He was sarcastic, saying, 'Cry aloud, for he is God.' Either he is musing," okay, so maybe he's off thinking about how he's going to respond or not respond. "Either he is musing," and then here we go. I told you Elijah's a country boy, a little bit crude, not refined. Elijah says, maybe he is relieving himself. And if you go to the Hebrew, it means maybe he is relieving himself. In other words, maybe he's on the John. Okay, we're just being honest here. Maybe Elijah, Baal had to take a bathroom break. Don't blame me. It's in the Bible. I told you we're a Bible-teaching church here at City Church. Baal is relieving himself. Go check the stalls. Look under the door. See if you see some divine feet under there somewhere. I don't even know what that looks like. They have like flames coming off of his sandals or something. I don't know. Maybe he is relieving himself. He's thinking. Maybe he's going to the bathroom. Don't you like a prophet that's got a little bit of trash talk in them? I don't even know where I'm at. He is relieving himself. Maybe he's away on a journey. Perhaps he's asleep. Go wake him up. Man, this got under their skin. They cried aloud, and they cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. Man, what a vivid, gruesome picture. Cutting themselves until the blood ran freely. Now, I don't want to chase this rabbit, but you can see here. Don't let it always scare you when I say I don't want to chase this rabbit, but these guys are worshiping a false god, and they did it until the end result was violence against themselves. I'll tell you, it's a pretty clear picture of the pursuit of false gods. Paul picks up on it in Romans chapter 1, that the end result of pursuing false gods is most often violence. It ends in violence. I mean, are we a violence-laden culture or what? Are we a culture that's fascinated with violence in a way that it's entertaining, but in a way that's very gruesome? I mean, how many people have died in the last few years from people that worship false gods that ultimately end in
violence. Now, let's be quick to say that Christians haven't always had the best reputation of that either throughout world history. But when it happened in Christianity, it was a violation of what Christianity teaches at its core. Some might argue that about other religions as well. But at the end of the day, what a picture of false prophets proclaiming false gods who end up cutting themselves and bleeding out for their God. As Elijah mocks them and taunts them, he's the Muhammad Ali of prophets as he talks trash to them. Listen to this. Spiritual rituals, religious devotion to false gods, spiritual devotion, religious rituals to false gods produce nothing. Some of the most religiously devoted people in the world are praying to a God who cannot hear, who cannot listen. And in the end, in the story of Elijah and the story of today, spiritual rituals, religious devotion to a false God, ultimately it condemns its adherents, the people that adhere to it, that follow it, that pursue it. It condemns them because the false God cannot hear, cannot listen. It turns violent against them. Verse 29, as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. Listen to the sadness of these phrases. There was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. Religiously devoted, cutting themselves, dancing, worshiping, all day. I mean, they've got me beat when it comes to spiritual devotion to a God. I mean, I haven't spent all day running around my house, dancing and worshiping and cutting myself, trying for God to hear me. I haven't done that. And yet at the end of the day, their spiritual devotion only led them to condemnation because they were praying to a God who could not hear. No voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. The picture's sad. Some have said that the prophets can't make bell, but that's a very cheesy joke, so I'm not going to use it. No voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. It's a sad picture, and the narrative of the Bible is very clear, isn't it? There is only one true God. All other gods are false. Verse 30. Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. So there's some deep symbolism there that the altar of the God has been destroyed. Elijah rebuilds it. 31, he took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the son of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. Again, some deep symbolism we don't have time to get into here. Remember, this is a divided kingdom that we talked about in the very first week, that the Boam brothers had divided the kingdom. You see what Elijah does here? The purpose of God's people was not division, it was unity. He rebuilds with the 12 stones to symbolize God's intention. God's ideal was for you guys to be together, not apart. And so Elijah rebuilds the altar. Israel shall be your name. 32, and with stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. He made a trench about the altar as great as it would contain 2 seahs of seed, and he put the wood in order. He cut the bull in pieces, and he laid it on the wood, and he said, now remember, this is during a drought. Water is scarce and limited. He says, fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. You ever tried to light wet wood? Right? If you're on the show Alone, you better know how to light wet wood. If you're on Survivor, you better know how to light some wood. You ever tried to light wood that's been soaked for days? And so Elijah says, do it 3 times. Again, we don't have time to get into all the symbolism here, but they wet the wood and the water, 35, and the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. Elijah did not want there to be any doubt about what was about to take place. 36, and at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, listen to his prayer, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Listen to these words. let it be known this day how awesome of a prophet I am. No. Let it be known this day that Elijah was right and Ahab was wrong. Let it be known this day that you are God in Israel. I am your servant, and all that I have done, all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let no one escape." And they seized them. Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. You see, this showdown was not really a royal rumble between gods. There is only one God, and He has no equals. This was not who's going to win the fight. This is not tooth and nail down to the last round. This is not take it to the judges' scorecards to see who won. This is no showdown. This is no rumble. This is no battle. This is no face-to-face, toe-to-toe. There is only one God. He has no equals. This story simply reveals again the premise of all of Scriptures, the supremacy of God above all things. Above kings, above false gods, above people, above prophets, above creation itself. It's the first command, I am the Lord your God. There is no other. You shall not bow down to any other God because there is no other God. There is one who is supreme, who is sovereign, and there are no equals to our God. Let me end the Mount Carmel story with just three quick reminders and challenges from this epic display of supremacy. Reminder, there is only one true God, and He is supreme over all. He is supreme over what you're facing. He is supreme over all the earth. He's not caught off guard. Our challenge from this reminder is to worship Him. All other gods are false. They are deaf. They are incapable of providing. They are powerless. There is no other God. There is one supreme God. Worship Him. Jehovah God is the true God, the attentive God, the capable God, the powerful God. He is the only legitimate God. Worship Him as the supreme God. This story reminds us there is one God. He is the true God. Worship Him. This story also reminds us that idolatry is ultimately a matter of the heart. It's a heart issue. Idolatry is not about stones, images, and metal statues and golden calves. Idolatry is ultimately a matter of the heart. And our challenge is stop limping between opinions and follow. Let me encourage you, if the Lord is God, follow Him. Follow Him. Don't limp along between opinions. Follow Him. Worship Him. Devote yourself to Him. Make Him supreme in your time, in your finances, in your energies, in what you teach your children. Make Him supreme in all things. If He is God, follow Him. Our challenge is, who sits on the throne of my life today? What sits on the throne of my heart today? If there's something out there besides the one true God that deserves to be God, then by all means, go all in with it. Follow it. Devote yourself to it. If it's about money, go for it. Make as much as you can. But if it's not about money, if there is one true God who is who He claims to be, then devote yourself to Him. Follow Him. Give yourself to Him. Idolatry is ultimately an issue of our hearts. And then our last reminder is this: the greatest showdown of all time was not on Mount Carmel, it was on Mount Calvary. It takes us back to the gospel.
The story of Elijah was pointing ahead to a time of a bigger showdown, a more supreme showdown, a divine showdown when Jesus would ascend the hill of Mount Calvary and wear the weight of the cross on his back, and where the enemy of God would be defeated once and for all through the death of Jesus Christ. Baal is a false god. Satan is a false god. The defeat of Baal on Mount Carmel is simply a picture of a divine redemptive plan that was unfolding, that would reach its climax on Mount Calvary when Jesus and Jesus alone would ascend the mountain as the ultimate and final prophet of God, the complete revelation of God. And he would stand on Mount Calvary and he would defeat the enemy once and for all. It points us to the gospel. Why does God not send fire today? We read this story and like, man, if that happened out on the bridge between here and Huntsville, like, we built some altars and fire poured down, like, people would be convinced, wouldn't they? Like, everybody would turn to God. Why does fire not fall from heaven today to prove the validity of who God is? Why does God not send down fire? Well, let me say this first. Fire is temporary and inadequate. I mean, did God do it here? You want to read one chapter over what the people of Israel were doing after this happened? Their hearts were turned away from God again. Because it wasn't about the fire. Ultimately, it was about their heart. Idolatry is always a heart issue. But here's the real reason why, and the ultimate reason why God does not pour fire down from heaven. The writer of the book of Hebrews says this: long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. God was speaking through Elijah to his people, and he was proclaiming. Look at verse 2. But in these last days, he has spoken to us, how? By his Son, by Jesus, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God. Jesus is the exact imprint of the nature of God. Jesus upholds the universe by the word of his power. Jesus made purification for sins. Jesus sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Jesus has become superior to the angels as the name of Jesus has been inherited as more excellent than theirs. The reason God doesn't pour down fire from heaven is because Jesus is the ultimate and final revelation display of who God is. The reason is because Jesus has done everything necessary. He's the complete and final revelation, revealing of who God is. We don't need fire from heaven. You know why? Fire from heaven's temporary. That doesn't change your heart. We have Jesus, the ultimate revelation of God. We don't need heavenly bread that falls and feeds us in the mornings. We don't need ravens that come by the brook and feed us. You know why? We have Jesus. He's the ultimate revelation of God. And he fought the ultimate battle. He won the greatest showdown of all time. So our challenge is we turn to Jesus. We rest in Jesus. Jesus is more than enough. And it's why I say to you over and over and over and over again, we preach the gospel to ourselves every day. We need the gospel every day, because the good news is that when Jesus is on the throne of my life, when Jesus is at the center of my life, when Jesus is my highest priority in life, then my identity, my security, my confidence, my acceptance, my value is not based on how I feel. It's not based on how others feel about me. It's not based on how successful or unsuccessful I am. It's not based on how successful my kids are or not. It's not based on whether my kid succeeds in a certain sport. It's not based on how much money is in my bank account. When Jesus is at the center of my life, my fulfillment, my confidence, my security, my value is not rocked by the temporary feelings of this world. It's based on who God is. It's based on who Jesus is.
And that gets me through the good times, the bad times, the healthy relationships, the broken relationships. It gets me through when there's money in the bank and not money in the bank. It gets me through when we can eat the finest foods and we do not know where the next meal is coming from. It will get me through life. My identity is not based on what the kid down the row from me thinks about me at school. My identity is not based on how I look, how I feel, whether the boss appreciates me or not. My identity is found in the one who, in the final showdown and greatest showdown, won my victory so that I can stand complete in Him, in Christ alone. That's the gospel. That's the good news.